Our scripture reading today comes from Luke 9, verses 28 through 36. Now about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up to the mountaintop to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as these men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. And as he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud, saying, This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. This is the word of the Lord. Yesterday, I was back in Virginia for my grandfather's funeral, and I really appreciate all the prayer and kind words that you all have given me today and the week before. I know that each of us have been to far too many funerals, and I'm wondering if you have the same experience I have, if you have the same anxieties. There's two things that I'm concerned about when I'm at a funeral. The first is that I'm always worried about getting stuck in a long conversation with the one person that you really don't want to talk to. There's always someone, and you know that they mean well, but you really don't want to hear their take on the proceedings. You know, as soon as they make their way over to you, you start looking for a way to kind of evade them and escape to a different conversation. This happened yesterday, and I noticed that first my dad, and then myself, and then my mom made a good escape, and then we forgot about Jenny, and we looked back, and Jenny was still there, and we're like, do we get back in the fray, or do we leave Jenny to fend for herself? And the other concern is a more serious one that I think often we're too afraid to speak out loud. Did our loved one really know Jesus? Did he or she have a relationship with him? They have salvific knowledge, or do they simply go through the motions? Did they attend church? Did they give of their time and money without really giving themselves to Christ? See, when we read the Gospels, like we've been reading John for the past few months, we see these religious officials who recognize Jesus as a teacher, but they don't fully understand him. We see insiders and the elite, we see them question Jesus. We even see demons who recognize him. We see many examples of people who might, from the outside, appear to have a part of the picture. Our Sunday school class has been going through this study, Only Two Religions, and it's a little bit complicated, but it breaks down the similarities between secular, pagan, and other religious philosophies. Because other major religions even recognize that Jesus is an example of good morals and an ethical teacher. But this is not enough for us, because Jesus is so much more than a teacher of morality, so much more than an example of a godly life, so much more than a miraculous healer, a gifted speaker, or an inspirational figure. And that's what we're talking about this morning. Are we people who are caught up in the cultural trappings of Christianity, people who like church because of how it makes us feel or because it makes us a better spouse? Do we like the label itself? Or are we really people who understand that Jesus is so much more than what the people of the Old Testament were expecting based on prophecies and prototypes, so much more than what the disciples who are following Jesus understood him to be, and so much more than what we expect or imagine? This morning, we're looking at the Transfiguration, and I want us to think about how in this moment we see Jesus is so much more in terms of his unique glory and his unique authority. So first, let's talk about the glory of Jesus on display in this text. So the disciples have seen what we've seen so far in this series. They're the same place we are. They've seen some amazing things that Jesus has done. They've seen healings, teachings, and they've started to suspect that Jesus has a special sort of power, has a special access to God. Earlier in this chapter, Peter starts to recognize that Jesus is the Messiah. See, here three of the disciples see Jesus clothed in a dazzling white and talking with Elijah and Moses, who are appearing in glory. What's going on here? Seems a little bit supernatural or strange. You know, sometimes as Christians, we use words that aren't actually in the Bible to help us understand important biblical themes or theological concepts. The incarnation comes to mind, the Trinity. The Jewish rabbis did this as well, and there's a term that they used. It was called the Shekinah glory, that described the physical manifestations of God's glory in the Old Testament. And Christians use the word theophany, which literally means a showing of God, to describe a similar thing. But the reason I bring up the Shekinah glory is that it helps underscore the glory at play in this text. Jesus' dazzling glory, and it puts it into an Old Testament lens for us. See, Moses, who is present in this story, is the Old Testament figure most closely associated with Shekinah glory. In Exodus 13, God leads his people, and it says, "And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so they might travel by day and by night." You've probably heard this, the pillar of smoke and the pillar of fire. Later in Exodus, in chapters 32 through 34, Moses asks to see God's glory. He wants to see it. God tells Moses that if he sees it, he'll die. And so instead of allowing him to see it firsthand, he protects him in a cleft or a gap in the rocks. He covers him, and then he lets him look at his afterglow as he passes by. After this, Moses stays up there for 40 days while God dictates the Ten Commandments to him. And when Moses goes down the hill, 40 days later, he's still glowing with the reflection of God's glory. Then at the end of Exodus, God creates the tabernacle and he displays his glory. Later in the Holy of the Holies, which is the inner sanctum of the temple, the glory was so powerful that only one person, the chief priest, was only allowed to enter once a year, and they would tie a belt or a sash around his waist with a bell, and so they could pull him out because his life was in danger if he came into too much contact with the overwhelming glory of God. In Judaism, they celebrate the Feast of the Tabernacles. That's what Peter is talking about here. It's actually the right time. And during the Feast of the Tabernacles, they would build booths and they would or tents, and they would stay there for a week to remember how God had provided for them in the desert and how he provided for them in the present. This is all of the context that underscores our text today. When we read that Jesus' face was altered, that his clothes became dazzling white, that Moses and Elijah appeared in glory, and that a cloud came that created a shadow that made the disciples scared. Jesus is the Feast of the Tabernacles. He is God incarnate, the perfect picture of God's providence. See, all of the glory of the Old Testament, the Shekinah glory, the theophanies, were imperfect representations of God's glory, that are better illustrated, better manifested, perfectly illustrated in Jesus. Jesus was more glorious than all of the old representations of God's glory. In our world, glory is very closely associated with power. I think we take glory, we take pride in how successful we are and how healthy we are in our children, our homes. I know one man, whenever I'm home and I run into him, he glories in telling me whatever luxurious car his son has recently bought. But we all glory in 1,000 little things because they are examples or testaments to our power, how we compare to others who have less than us. See, power and glory are obviously connected in our world, but they're also connected in God's realm. But Jesus not only possesses so much more glory and so much more power than we do, he also fundamentally changes what that power looks like. Let's look at this unique power of Jesus. We have this awe-inspiring Old Testament glory on display, and the cloud points out that it's focused on Jesus. See, at the beginning of the story, the disciples are amazed, but part of the reason they're amazed is that Moses and Elijah, who are very important in the faith, in the Jewish faith, not to mention the fact that they've both been dead for quite a long time at this point, but they are so amazed that Moses and Elijah have appeared and are intentionally seeking out, talking to their leader, to Jesus. When we see God's glory displayed and manifest in Jesus, we realize that it's not just that the Jesus is important enough that Moses and Elijah would seek him out. It's not even that he's on the same level or worthy of Moses and Elijah's time, but it's the fact that he is superior. He is uniquely the continuance of Moses and Elijah and the superior. We need to remember that Moses was probably the most important figure in the Old Testament. And so the Jewish disciples, Moses' presence is amazing. But this story shows that they are not equal. Moses and Jesus are not equal. Jesus is so much more. Moses is the one who led the Israelites out of Egypt and out of Exodus. And this is kind of interesting, maybe a little nerd tangent. But the word in our text today, the Greek word, which is translated as departure, is actually the same word for Exodus. It's actually literally Exodus. And so if you wanted to read it that way, you could read it literally, Moses and Elijah appeared in glory and talked to Jesus about his Exodus, the one that would lead to Jerusalem. His Exodus, his departure, which is in fact more important than the Exodus of the Old Testament that we associate with Moses that lasted for 40 years and which the entire nation of Israel has been discussing for generations. See, Moses is associated with drawing the people together and bringing them out of suffering. Elijah is always mentioned in terms of eschatology or final salvation or preparing the way for the Messiah. But Jesus better fulfills both of these roles. He is the new and better Moses, the new and better Elijah. He will draw the people around himself. He will pull them out of exile. He will provide salvation. He is so much more than Moses and Elijah. And this realization frightens the disciples. When they see God's cloud, they grow afraid. Now, at first, this fear seemed kind of strange to me. I mean, they were following Jesus. I think normally when you're following somebody, you want them to live up to the highest calling or live up to their best performance. And I think that I would assume they were hoping that Jesus was this glorious, was this unique and this powerful. Why would they be scared when they saw what they wanted to see? But the more I thought about it, the more I thought that this makes sense because of the awesome power on display. It made me think about Robert Oppenheimer and the other scientists who worked at the Manhattan Project and developed the first nuclear bomb. They spent so much time working on this project, and they were successful. And then, after they were done, they saw the true power of what they had done, and they grew fearful. Oppenheimer famously went to the White House and told President Truman that he felt like he had blood on his hands. So Jesus is obviously a different sort of power than the atomic bomb, but they are both powerful enough to invoke fear. N.T. Wright is a New Testament scholar who wrote on this fear of the disciples, quote, "How can you live with the terrifying thought that the hurricane has become human, that the fire has become flesh, that life itself came to life and walked in our midst? Christianity either means that or it means nothing. It is either the most devastating disclosure of the deepest reality in the world, or it's a sham, a nonsense. Most of us are unable to cope with saying either of these things, and we condemn ourselves to live in the shallow world between." Christianity either means that Jesus is so much more powerful than we can imagine, or it means nothing. Earlier in this week, I was just going to leave it at that, but as I went through the week, this line just kept on eating at me and kept repeating all the ramifications this has for our lives. Christianity either means that Jesus is so much more powerful than we can imagine, or it means nothing. If we believe that Jesus is this powerful, then it trumps all the other powers present in our world. And we can look around. We don't have to be scholars to see the world around us and know that there are situations that are desperate for power. People who need something. There are people who are sick or dying, people who are hungry or homeless, people who are depressed or confused, people who live in environments of violence, war, danger, or disaster. These are people in our communities and in our world who are desperately seeking real power, hope, people who are hopeless on their own, and the good news is that Jesus has power to meet all of those needs. We can also look around in our culture and we can see abuses of earthly power. A lot of the problems in our society could be boiled down to power dynamics. You could look at economic disparity or economic power with the stratification of wealthy and poor. You could look at my favorite definition of racism is racial prejudice plus power. To use that, the dirtiness of politics is really about power accumulation. You could look at sexism or sexual violence as devolving from the power that men have over women or the power that adults have over children. But all of these uses and abuses of power are doing so with an inferior power. If we are Christians, we believe that the power of Jesus is so much more than the power that we see people use to profit off of others and to lift themselves up. This is what we believe in. Either we believe that Jesus is a manifestation of the full glory of God and has the power to accomplish everything, the power to raise the dead, the authority to pay for sins, the power to provide hope in the midst of suffering, and freedom from abuse, or we are wasting our time. This is why the voice of God comes down from the cloud and says, "This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him." This story, this moment is called the Transfiguration, which literally means a complete change of form or appearance into a more beautiful or more spiritual state. It's a pivotal moment in the gospel because it shows Jesus in his full glory. It lets the reader in on who Jesus really is, on how glorious he is, and how powerful he is. This is kind of like, I think this is the third time I've referenced Rocky since I've been here, but it's kind of like in every single Rocky training sequence where at first he can't get up the mountain or he can't beat Apollo on the beach, and then by the end of the song, he's successful. He's ready for the final battle. This is what's happening, that Jesus is now fully prepared for where he is going. You see, chapter 9 is a turning point in the Gospel of Luke. Earlier in this chapter, the disciples start to realize that Jesus is the Messiah. Here, the transfiguration happens, and he is clothed in his full glory and revealed to the disciples and the reader. And a few verses later, in 9:51, we read that when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. That's the exile that he was talking about with Moses and Elijah. Now, he doesn't get to Jerusalem until chapter 19 in Luke. So we have 10 chapters left until the triumphal entry on Palm Sunday. And there's much more that is going to happen in the story of Jesus. But right here in chapter 9, the gospel shifts and it's less concerned with who Jesus is or his identity, but on what he will do as the new and better Moses, the new and better Elijah. We are now geared up and preparing for the finale. So what does this mean for us? What does this mean in our lives, the transfiguration? How does it apply? I want to look back at God's words from the cloud where he says, "This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him." You know, some of this saying, "This is my son, my chosen one," it's a continuation or direct quote, in fact, from Jesus' baptism that we studied a few months ago. In fact, in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Mark, they have a similar story, but they use the exact wording of the baptism. But here, Luke includes an extra phrase, "Listen to him," which comes from Deuteronomy 18 after God reveals his glory to Moses. The "listen to him" is a unique command in Luke's version of the story, and I think it's the best way we can apply this lesson of the Transfiguration. See, Jesus has been displayed as so much more glorious and so much more powerful than we cannot merely treat him as inspiration, but we must follow him, we must respect his authority and allow him to transform us. Last week, a few of my friends were visiting, and whenever we get together, we like to argue about theology. I know that's pretty nerdy, doesn't sound like fun for most of you, but we really enjoy it. Some of you think, oh, like Tim, he seems pretty normal and cool for a pastor, but I'm not normal or cool. Anyway, so we were hanging out, and we were talking about a couple of issues where we really disagreed with each other. And then we realized that we were all citing the exact same scriptures and applying them differently. Each of us was earnestly attempting to listen to God, but our end result was so clouded by our preconceptions that we ended in different places. We each started searching, expecting to find that the Bible agreed with us. You know, this is called confirmation bias, right? It happens to all of us. We all look to God hoping that he's going to tell us that we are in the right. He's going to tell us that it's okay when we get frustrated with our spouse or our jobs, our families, our neighbors, and our friends. We all want God to agree with us on our denominational stance, on our theology, on our favorite type of worship music, our political positions, how much time and money we give to the church. We want to see God agree. It's why I was talking to Phil about this week. It's why in the South we had these churches full of Christians who supported slavery or opposed civil rights because the pastors and those people listened to God only as much as they heard reflected themselves or they saw themselves reflected. They looked and they found agreement instead of being convicted of their own sins and how to better follow him. Too often we do this. We reference God's authority without actually seeking it. Too often we look to God, but we squint and we only see a reflection of ourselves. But God is not a simple mirror reflecting our beliefs, our thoughts, our hopes, or our expectations. He is so much more than that. So to apply the Transfiguration to our lives, we must approach our time in the Word, our time in prayer, and our time in community open to learning new things, hard things, things that in some ways we might prefer we didn't learn. Because the chances are that God might be calling us to follow Jesus somewhere that's different than where we currently are. He might be calling us out of the deeper water like he did with the fishermen. Maybe he's asking you to commit to studying the scripture seriously for the first time or for stepping up into a leadership role here at the church. He might be calling you to drop everything and follow him like he did with the first disciples. Maybe he wants you to forgive someone, to let go of some grudge or prejudice that you've been holding on to, or let go of a habit or an addiction that's separating you from him. Or maybe he's calling you to do less. Maybe he's calling you to rest in him, to abide in him like the vine or like in Psalm 23, to allow him to work in you by stilling your busyness, your activeness, so you can focus on him and follow his will. We must listen to him. That's our job, to better listen to him, to better follow him, and to better obey him. And this is the good news for us this morning, is that if we respect God's unique authority and apply this in our lives, if we obey him and listen to him, then we can access his unique glory. Because Christ is so much more glorious and so much more powerful than anything that has come before him, than anything that will come after him, and that he can transfigure us. He can completely change our form into a more beautiful and spiritual version of ourselves. He can use his power to bring us into his glory.